I'm very glad to be at Wido for the first time in my life. I did a PhD program that was directed by one of the former directors, Giovanni Andrea Corna. So when I was a PhD student, Wido was really a mythical place on earth for us. So I'm glad to be here for the first time. So our paper that is still very much a work in progress, so don't hesitate to interrupt me and ask questions throughout the presentation, starts from a very simple observation. Mexican migration to the United States typically occurs in stages, with men migrating first, leaving behind their wives and their children, who might join them in the United States at a later stage. This pattern is partly related to the fact that most of migration flows nowadays are undocumented, so rather expensive for an household and also extremely risky, so that households tend to diversify. If we consider anthropological and sociological accounts of Mexican migration, we often find reference to the fact that the individuals that are left behind by the migrants modify their co-resident choices, meaning that they start co-residing with other individuals that were not co-residing with when the migrant was still in Mexico. This basic observation, and I'll provide you a few examples in the next slide, calls into question an assumption that is usually maintained in the economics literature, and the migration literature makes no exception in this respect, meaning that household structure, household composition is regarded either as fixed or at least as exogenous with respect to the object of our analysis. In the case of migration and the implications of migration on the individuals left behind, this assumption means that aside from the migration episode, there's no further variation in household composition. This is an anthropologist working on Mexico, and Deborah Boehm is relating the story of an husband who went to New Mexico, and his wife, Jasmine, decided to stay with her parents rather than following the tradition of moving to her husband's community. And Jasmine said that her mother is great help with her toddler son. So the wife joining the household of her own parents after the migrant has left. Or Joanna Trevi, Divided by Borders, another book in 2010, where she makes the observation that most of the times when then the wife also joins the husband in the United States, the children that are left behind tend to coincide with grandparents, and in particular with maternal rather than paternal grandparents. Again, a shift away from the predominant patrilocal character of co-residence in Mexico, where new married couples tend either to coincide with the parents of the husband or to live close by the parents of the husband. Why a changing pattern of co-residence for the left behind in households that sent a migrant to the United States is interesting also for us, for economists? Well, because this actually can, a shifting pattern of co-residence can produce significant economic effects and also influence our understanding of the consequences of migration for the individuals left behind. In particular, the co-residence with the previous generation could soften the trade-off that wives left behind face between caring for their children and being active on the Mexican labor market. Furthermore, co-residence with another generation could reduce the information asymmetries that characterize lives in what are called in the literature transnational households, so households that are partly split between two countries. They could influence the way in which remittances are used. There is evidence that migrants, the paper by Ashraf and co-authors on the Review of Economics and Statistics, tend to send more money back home when they are able to retain a greater control over their use. There's evidence by Joe Zelat on JD that internal migrants in Kenya devote considerable time and effort to monitor the behavior of the wives left behind in rural villages. Okay, so, and for instance, for the migrant, having his wife left behind co-residing with his own parents could represent a monitoring device, okay, trying to have a better information about what she is doing. And these, as I said, could influence decisions concerning the use of remittances by those left behind. Furthermore, what is interesting for analytical reasons is that if we have a change in the co-residence patterns of the individuals left behind, then typical retrospective questions on the occurrence of migration episodes could simply miss migration episodes. And I will try to explain why in right away. So let's consider the question that is contained in the survey associated to the 2010 Mexican census, one of the two main data sources that we're going to use in this paper. This question represents, if you want, the gold standard in terms of asking questions about absent household members who have moved to another country, and it's in line with the recommendations set by the United Nations. So the question reads as follows. During the last 5 years, that is from June 2005 to today, has any person who lives or lived with you in this household gone to live in another country? If the respondent gives a positive answer to this question, then he has to list how many migrants and separately the name of all these migrants. And then the interviewer goes on asking the following questions separately for each migrant. When name of the migrant left for the last time, was he or she living with you? Okay, so the key issue here is that we want the surveyed household to report information on migration episodes only related to individuals that were members of the surveyed household at the time of migration. If this coresidence condition defined at the time of migration is violated, then the migration episode is not reported. And you don't find any trace of it in the publicly available version of the data. The issue is that if we see a lot of instances in which the left behind, the wife and the children, join the household of the parents of the wife after the migration of the husband, then the migration of the husband is going to remain unrecorded in the data. Why? Precisely because the husband was not part of the household that is surveyed, the one composed by the wife, but also by her parents, at the time in which he left Mexico. So we asked the INEGI to provide us with information about how many times the co-residence condition in question one, in question five, was violated, and this occurs in roughly 8% of all the cases in which they managed to enumerate a migrant. Even though this is a lower bound of the relevance of missing migration episodes because of the violation of the co-residence condition. Why? Because you should see that the only difference between the initial question and the second question is that it's only the second question that clarifies that the co-residence condition has to be evaluated at the time of migration. So in the case that I described, the household might already give a negative answer to the first question if the husband never co-resided with his in-laws before leaving Mexico. Okay, so here, in theory, you should give a positive answer if this condition was satisfied at some point in the past, but violated then at the time of migration. Okay, so in a previous paper that I published earlier this year with Eli Murar on the JD, we rely on a different data source, a panel survey that allows following Mexican households for 5 quarters to see to what extent after the occurrence of a migration episode we observe a further variation in household composition, notably new members joining the household from where the migrant left. And indeed we find that the occurrence of a migration episode is significantly associated with further changes in household composition. But the data that we use in this paper didn't allow us to observe all the instances of changes in household composition, because as I told you, we typically are able to observe new members joining a household, but we are not able to observe what happens if this household moves to a different housing unit. So if the wife with the children joins the house of her parents, this would lead to attrition in the panel survey. They are not able to track that. Okay. So this also means that we're not able to fully characterize the new individuals with whom they start co-residing. And furthermore, this is a short rotating panel survey. We only follow households for up to 12 months, so we don't know whether the variations that we observe are a short-run phenomenon or it's something that is going to persist over time. So what we're going to do in this paper is to try to give a better answer to these 3 points, or to provide an answer to these 3 points that were not addressed in our previous paper. And so what we do is that basically we combine 2 different data sources to get a sense of the extent to which after the migration of an individual, there are further variations in the composition of his household of origin after, as I said, the migration to the United States. And in particular, we observe the correspondence pattern of married couples where the husband migrates over this 5 years period. This is the 5 years period covered by the 2010 census. And we observe the correspondence patterns just before migration, using this panel survey where we can identify at one point in time the migration of an individual. And we're going to ask ourselves which was the household composition right before the husband left and a few years after migration, using the questions from the 2010 census. And we're going to compare the two. What, in particular, rather than relying directly on the explicit question on the occurrence of a migration episode, that are exposed to the threat of non-enumeration of the migration episode in case of a change in household composition, we try to isolate a group of women in the 2010 census that are very likely to be married to an international migrant, irrespective of whether they report their husband as a migrant or not. In particular, we focus on women that are married, but that do not coincide with their spouse. We have an explicit question on these, and who report to be personally, directly receiving remittances from abroad. We think that with these three ingredients, we are able to identify a group of women that are likely to have been left behind by a migrant husband. We compare, as I said, their co-resident choices with whom they are living with. Yes?
Just a question about how do you interview, in the census, is every member of the household interviewed, or how are you sure that you actually... There's
a principal respondent. Okay. So the INEGI gives us the identifier of the principal informant. But it doesn't mean that it was the only one. So questions, even about individual household members, are either asked to the main respondent or to the member himself or herself. He or she was present at the time of the interview. This we don't know. We only know who was the main respondent.
Okay, so could it be that in some cases you were lucky and they interviewed the
person? Sure, this makes a difference. I'm gonna show it. Yeah. This makes a difference. So we compare the correspondent choices of these women in the census with those observed from the NOI, this panel survey, right before the husbands moved out. And we analyze whether changes in correspondence choices that we do observe in the data are indeed correlated with the non-enumeration of the migrant using the standard retrospective questions in the 2010 census. And then we try to understand whether women that and children that modified their correspondence choices after the migration of an household member differ in relevant observable characteristics from those that did not. Okay? Are they randomly selected on observables or not? And what we find is that a large share of the wives left behind, as the anthropological and sociological literature suggests, steps away from traditional co-residence patterns, patrilocality, and rather opts for matrilocality, so co-residence with the parents of the wife. And this effect is greatly magnified by the presence of babies and children, small age children. And the observed change in co-residence patterns dramatically increases the probability that the husband of this wife is not enumerated as a current migrant. So we would totally miss this migration episode if we only relied on the standard retrospective question. And furthermore, this also entails, given that these women and also their children that adjust their correspondence pattern appear to have some to be non-randomly selected on observable characteristics such as education or labor force participation for the women or school attendance for the children left behind, we would get just a partial and biased picture of the children of the individuals left behind by relying simply on standard questions. Our paper, which is ongoing, the final goal, as I'll try to make clear at the end of the presentation, is to try to develop a theoretical framework that is able to allow us to think jointly about migration choices and co-resident choices, is related to the literature that analyzes the effects of migration on the individuals left behind. The limited numbers of paper, but growing, that is analyzing the implications of the endogeneity of household composition, starting from a seminal paper on the Review of Economic Studies by Andrew Foster and Mark Rosenzweig. And more broadly, we are related to models, summarized into a book chapters by Marcel Fachon, of both intra-household decision-making and relationship of an household with members of the extended family. We are related to both because our argument is that we need to take into account that the boundaries between what is the household and what is the rest of the family are shifting over time. Okay, so let me introduce the two main data sources that we use here. The first one is the Encuesta Nacional de Ocupación y Empleo, so a rotating panel survey run by the INEGIF since 2005, which basically introduces 20,000 households in the sample every quarter and then follow them for five interviews. Given that we have the household roster at different point in time, we can identify instances in which an household member disappears and remaining household members are asked the question, what happened to him or to her? And one of the answers is migrated to the United States. So we can identify instances from the second to the fifth interview in which one of the members initially included in the household roster has migrated. And we focus on the waves of this survey that allow identifying the migration episodes occurring over the same time period that is covered by the 2010 census, so that we can try to understand which was the pattern of co-residence of the households that send out a migrant right before the migrant left Mexico. Then we use the large survey connected to the 2010 census that was administered to around 2.9 million Mexican households. And this contains questions for each household member on marital status, co-residence with a spouse and with one's own parents, receipt of remittances from abroad, separately from each member aged 12 and above, and retrospective questions on migration of former household member that I already introduced. So, as I said, we focus on a group of women that are likely to have been left behind by a migrant husband who moved abroad. Which are the ingredients that we use? We use clearly the fact that they are married, they report not to be co-residing with a spouse, and that they report to be receiving remittances from abroad. For these women, then what we can also do is that we can search whether the household to which they belong to at the time of this survey in June 2010 actually is reporting a male that is likely to be their husband's as a current international migrant. Okay? So we focus in particular on women aged 20 to 49 at the time of the survey. We have a bit more than 3,000 of them from the NOE observed right before their husbands moved out of Mexico, and around 20,000 of them from the survey connected to the 2010 census. We can also use information on married co-residing couples to have information about the co-residence patterns of those that decided to stay in Mexico. We are going to use two narrow definitions, narrower than that are typically used in the literature because of data constraints, of patrilocality and matrilocality, which are defined as follows. We refer to patrilocality as co-residence with the parents of the husband, and matrilocality as co-residence with the parents of the wife. The broader definition would be not just co-residence with, but also close by. Unfortunately, neither the NOE, nor the census, nor other typical Mexican surveys, such as the ENA did, report information on the municipality of birth. Otherwise, we could have also looked at whether spouses were residing after the wedding in their municipality of birth, so like close to their parents, or they had moved out. We are unable to implement this definition, which is why we have to resort to these stricter ones. So now what I'm plotting here, I have five age groups from 20 to 24 up to 45 to 49 for the wife. And I'm reporting on the vertical axis what is the share of wives with a patrilocal living arrangement, so co-residing with their parents-in-law, right before their husband migrated. And you see that patrilocality is strongly dependent on age. It's more common right after the wedding, and then it declines when households are probably, couples are probably able to create an independent household. If I compare these with the similar figures from the census, which means probably typically a few years after the migration of the husband, we see little to no variation, or if anything, a slight decline in the share of wives that co-reside with their parents-in-law. Differences, except for this age group, are not statistically significant. If I look at wives that co-reside with their own parents, we get a totally different picture. Before migration, there are fewer wives that co-reside with their parents, but after their husbands move out, there's a drastic increase. So the typical pattern that we have in mind, but I will explain how we can corroborate this conjecture, is that there were households that were nuclear to begin with, and after the migration of the husband, the wife and the children left behind have joined, as sociological and anthropological accounts suggest, the households of their own parents. We also rely on data from DNOI to understand how the initial pattern, the probability of husband migration is related to the initial pattern of co-residence. So here we use also information on those who did not migrate, and we find that husbands have a higher probability of migrating out of patrilocal households. So they prefer to leave their wives with their own parents, while after the migration, wives have the opposite preference, and they tend to join, if they need help, for instance, the households of the parents of the wives. So, as I said, a possible explanation for this pattern in the data, albeit not the unique one, is that we had a dissolution of the household of origin of the migrant. So the household from which the migrant left no longer exists as such, because the wife and the children left behind have joined the household of the parents of the wife. How can we corroborate this? Well, by seeing whether this large increase in matrilocality correlates with the fact that the husband is not enumerated. As I told you, we can ask for each of the women in our sample from the 2010 census whether the household to which they belong to is reporting a man who's likely to be their husband as an international migrant. I have to say likely to be, because this survey doesn't give us information about the marital status of the migrant, we only know the sex, and it doesn't give us information about his relationship with current household members. So what we have to do is to search whether among the possibly empty set of current international migrants reported by the household, there's a man whose age is consistent with the fact that he is the husband of the wife observed in the data. And looking at the data from the census for the entire population, the typical age difference between the two spouses is either the husband is up to 10 years older than the wife, or the wife is up to 4 years younger. This range covers 95% of Mexican couples, Mexican married couples. And if I take the 20,000 women that for us are wives left behind by international migrants in the sample, we have that for 44.5% of them, we are not able to find their likely husband abound among the international migrants that are reported by the household. Clearly, this could be due to other factors. The questions in the census have a time frame after migration episodes occurring after June 2005. So this wife might have had her husband migrating, for instance, in 2003, and hence he would correctly not be enumerated, and this wouldn't have anything to do about the violation of the co-residence condition. Furthermore, we might face a problem of deliberate misreporting. Talking about the occurrence of an international migration episode when migration is undocumented is a sensitive issue. And there's evidence, there's a paper on demography by Hamilton and Saviner, that Mexican households are reluctant to tell the truth. Okay, so they might simply lie. But interestingly enough, what we do is that we run a regression where our dependent variable is a dummy, signaling that the husband of our wives left behind is not enumerated as a current international migrant, we see a striking difference with respect to whether the wife is coinciding with her own parents or with her parents-in-law. Only matrilocality, that should increase after the migration of the husband, is significantly and strongly associated with the probability that the husband is not enumerated as a current international migrant. The same thing does not occur in the case of patrilocality, where the effect is not significant. Why? Because patrilocality was already in place before migration. This is the traditional co-residence pattern, while the non-traditional co-residence pattern that emerges after the migration of the husband leads to a violation of the co-residence condition and hence substantially increases the probability of non-enumeration. Following up on the question that I got before, we can see what happens when it's the wife herself that is answering the question. And when it's the wife herself that is answering the question, the probability that the husband is not enumerated significantly declines. This is because, if you want, the question is a bit ambiguous. It's, was he living with you? So who's the, even though in Spanish is ustedes, so it's the plural. And the enumerator manual tells with all household members. It might be the case that respondents interpreted this question personally. Okay, so it makes a difference who answered the question. But the key thing is that, indeed, this result suggests that matrilocality emerges after, the increase in matrilocality emerges after the migration of the husband, with the dissolution of households that used to be nuclear at the time in which the husband left. What about the characteristics of these women? So now what we're going to do is a very simple exercise. We are going to compare the characteristics of the wives that co-reside with their parents, with their parents-in-law, and that remain in a nuclear household. And we're going to ask ourselves whether they differ in terms of levels of schooling or they differ in terms of their labor force participation at the time of the survey. Now, the regression on the same sample, where the dependent variable is the years of completed schooling of the wives left behind. The average in the sample is 7.6 years, higher in urban areas, 9.6, and lower clearly in rural areas, 6.8. And what we see is that matrilocality, so co-residence with the parents of the spouse, is significantly associated with a higher level of schooling. So it seems that these results suggest that the women that are able to move away from traditional co-residence patterns are better educated than those that either co-reside with their parents-in-law or that form a nuclear household. The effect is roughly 15% of the average, 1.1 years of schooling more. If we consider an initial thing that we had in mind, it was, okay, so maybe this can allow us to say something about the level of education of the migrants that are likely to remain unenumerated. Keep in mind that when wives join the household of their parents, their husbands remain not enumerated. Can we say something about their level of education? And the answer is actually no, because when we look at the data for the Mexican couples that are married and that co-reside, we see that differences in the levels of education between the two spouses are a strong predictor of the pattern of co-residence. And matrilocality among couples that co-reside is more likely when the wife is better educated than her husband. So the fact that the wives left behind that join the household of their parents are better educated than the other wives left behind doesn't necessarily entail that their husbands, that are likely to remain not enumerated in the data, are better educated. If we observe the same relationship between the pattern of co-residence, irrespective of whether the migrant migrates or not, we cannot state anything about the level of education of the migrants. What about labor force participation? This is a result that initially gave us a hard time to try to think about it. Because what we find when comparing the probability of employment in the week before the survey for women that co-reside with their parents-in-law, with the omitted category being part of a nuclear household, we find that the wives left behind that co-reside with the previous generation are significantly less likely to be active on the labor market. And the effect is sizable. So the average employment rate for the women in our sample is 25%, rather low, but co-residing, for instance, with the parents of the wives reduces this by 20%, by 5.3 percentage points. So it's a sizable effect. This is at odds with the narrative that we typically find in the anthropological and sociological literature, where, as I said, co-residing with the previous generation is a way to alleviate the tension between having to take care of the children while the husband is abroad and remaining active on the labor market. So what are the possible explanations? Well, clearly here it's just correlation, okay? So there are plenty of problems with omitted variables, and we have in mind two omitted variables that are likely to make a difference. So in particular, what we conjectured already in the previous paper is that there's huge evidence, as I said, that illegal migration from Mexico to the United States is very costly and very risky. And most of the times, non-co-residing family members step in to contribute finance the migration, the lumpy investment in migration. And a part of the deal could be we get remittances in exchange. Co-residing with a wife left behind can be a way to get a direct access to remittances. Okay? Furthermore, the fact that the parents of the wife have financed the migration decision is correlated with their socioeconomic conditions. And it's also correlated with the level of trust that they have with respect to their son-in-law. Because migration is a risky investment in the sense that it's also often associated to marriage dissolution. Remaining 4 years in different countries is not something that is typically very favorable to union stability. Okay, so what I'm saying is that the parents of the wife that are more likely to finance the migration of her son-in-law and then co-reside with their daughters are likely to have better socioeconomic conditions and to trust more their husband. And both factors can influence the labor supply of the wife. But there's also an alternative explanation that is, rather than co-residing with the parents to get help for taking care of the children, co-residence could reflect the existence of economies of scope if the wife left behind has at the same time to take care of children and of elderly members, the parents, that are aging and possibly with disabilities. We have this information in the census. 25% of the parents with whom the wives left behind co-reside have some form of physical or mental disability. So it's not necessarily always the case that they are able to lend a hand. And this could explain why the wives are less likely to participate on the labor market. But this is just a conjecture. You had a question.
What the labor market participation, is it employment or can it also be like self-employed?
It can also be self-employment. We have split the results between wage employment and self-employment or entrepreneurship. Everything is robust throughout. What about the children? As I said, we have in the census the identifiers of the parents when they are co-residing. So we can identify the children of the wife left behind. We have around 50,000 of them, age 0 to 18. We co-reside with their mothers, but not with their fathers, that, according to our story, has migrated to the United States. I'm presenting the age pyramid for boys and girls, 0 to 18, depending on whether they co-reside with maternal grandparents or they form part of a nuclear household. And you see that the co-residence pattern is strongly correlated with the age structure of the children. Co-residence with the grandparents is much more likely when the wife has preschool children, so from 0 to 5, for instance, while it becomes much less likely when boys are older. Clearly, if you change the age of the children, you are also implicitly changing in the back the age of the mother.
older mothers have not only older boys, but also probably older, if not already deceased, parents. So this can also explain the picture. But this result is robust also when we can control for the age of the mothers. So having young children, as anthropologists suggest, is strongly correlated with the co-resident choices of the wives left behind. If we look at school attendance, we see that the children that co-reside with their maternal grandparents and with their mother as well are more likely to be attending school. Here we are focusing on children aged 12 to 18, because in Mexico, school enrollment at the primary level is almost universal, so there's no effect there. Co-residing with maternal grandparents is significantly associated with a higher employment rate, enrollment rate, even when we control for the mother's years of schooling, because these mothers are more educated and this might be driving the effect, not entirely. Reduces the size of the coefficient, but it doesn't wash out these significant associations. Furthermore, what is interesting is that we can also try to get a sense of how often we have children that are likely to have been left behind by both parents. So in the census, we can focus on children, again, because we are interested in school attendance, age 12 to 18, that do not coincide with either of their parents, okay? And who belong to a household that receives remittances from abroad. Again, following the same logic, these children have presumably, but here the conjecture is weaker, be left behind by both parents. And interestingly, given that questions on remittances are asked to all household members age 12 and above, I can tell you that more than one third of these children reports personally receiving remittances. Okay, so this strengthens the conjectures that these are children left behind. 40% of them coincide with their grandparents. We are not able to say whether they are maternal or paternal, because given that we don't have the parents, we are not able to reconstruct the relationship. We only know that these are grandparents, although they are likely to be maternal grandparents. And 75% of these children belong to households that do not report any current international migrants. Again, why? Because if these children join these households when even their mother left, the co-residence condition, even for the mother, is violated. And this is interesting because I want to emphasize the following, a small step back in history. When the World Bank started including these type of questions, retrospective questions on the occurrence of migration episodes, in standard living standard measurement surveys, it did so out of concerns about what was the implications of parental migration for the children left behind. But the problem is that they are not capturing this. There are a lot of instances in which these children are simply not associated to any migration episode. It's the first time that the bank did so was from the country in which I did my PhD dissertation, Ecuador, precisely because of the rise in female migration to Spain that entailed that a lot of children were left behind. And again, they were asking questions about the migration of former household members. Okay, so...
Excuse me?
Yes?
This is basically because like the children are living with the grandparents and they kind of forget to report that children's parents are abroad?
It's not that they forget. It's that if they joined that household when, at the time in which their mother migrated, their mother was not a part of the household to which the children belonged to when she left Mexico. So it's not a problem of forgetting. It's a problem that it's coherently with the restrictions introduced by the survey, this migration episode is not reported. And what I would like to point out is that if I consider the school enrollment rate for these children left behind probably by both parents, this is nearly 20 percentage points below the corresponding enrollment rate for children left behind by the father but not by the mother. And furthermore, co-residence with grandparents rather than with other relatives, the typical alternative is aunts that take care of the children, is associated with a significantly higher school attendance, So who's the caregiver of the children left behind by both parents seems to be significantly associated with the probability that these children are attending school, and the effect is much stronger for girls. What we see in the data is that girls left behind by both parents that coincide with other caregivers have a much higher probability to devote entirely their time to household chores rather than study. And just to give you an idea of the magnitude of the effect, so here I'm comparing the probability of attending school for children that coincide with grandparents with respect to children that coincide with other caregivers. Parents are always away. And for girls, this results in an increase in the coresidence with their grandparents, increases the probability of being attending school by 17.5 percentage points with respect to the baseline enrollment rate of 54%. So it's a huge difference. In relative terms, it's around a 30% increase. And this is very much consistent with the fact that it seems that parents, when they have to migrate, prefer to leave their children with grandparents. My grandparents implicitly trust that the grandparents will spend the money wisely, keeping the best interests of their grandchildren in mind. But when the children live with other relatives, there is a high level of distrust over whether remittances are used to support the children. So this is what sociologists are writing about the preference. And indeed, it seems to be consistent with the data. Not only school enrollment, if I consider children that are attending school and I try to analyze what is the probability that they have repeated at least one grade, so that they are lagging behind with respect to their age, this probability is substantial, it's 26% in the sample. Coresidence with grandparents significantly reduces the probability of having repeated grades. So again, it's a different...
Can I ask a quick question?
Sure.
How does your estimate vary when you split the sample by rural and urban, considering the effect of the grandparents? Because
it's,
you didn't have significant effect for the rural grandparents, right?
I have both. It's in this. I was showing the disaggregation by sex of the children.
Yeah. So.
But even by rural urban, the effect is stable in this case, even though it's more pronounced in the rural areas.
No, like few slides back, you didn't have significant effect for the rural grandparents.
Yeah. The problem is that I haven't emphasized them too much because there's a radically different sample sizes in rural and urban areas. We have around 17,000 women in rural areas and 2,000 women in urban areas. So we have a problem with statistical power in urban areas. That's why I've reported the data, but I've not emphasized them too much.
Question, do you have data on, I don't know if this is common in Mexico, but send children to private schools?
No, we don't have information about school quality. The only other thing that we have is we have information about whether when the child is ill, whether they use public or private health facilities. This we do have. And coresidence with grandparents is more associated with the use of private health facility, but I wouldn't yet be able to tell you whether this means better quality or not. So what we would like to do then? We have so far only collected a series of stylized facts that we think are interesting per se, but for us, this is just only an input in a bigger project, that is to say, try to rationalize this and try to think jointly about migration decisions and co-resident choices for the individuals left behind. So we would need a model in which the migration decision is not simply taken at the household level, but it could involve, for instance, in terms of financing, other non-co-residing family members. Spouses can have divergent preferences with respect to with whom the wife left behind should co-reside after the migration of the husband. As I told you, the data suggests that husbands prefer to leave their wives, unsurprisingly, with their own parents. Wives have the opposite preference, and they shift after the husband has left. Co-residence can reduce information asymmetries that are pervasive in households that are separated by physical distance. And co-residence can lower the cost of the provision of some public goods. So as I told you, might be the case that you have economies of scope if you put under the same roof two-dependent individuals that were previously living not together. And we think that this is necessary to get a better understanding of what are also the implications of migration. Because what we get so far is a mixture of the direct effect that we would like to identify and correlated effects that are related to changes in the correspondent choices of the individuals left behind. Yeah?
Could you clarify a bit what you mean here by information asymmetries? I mean, if the husband, as I understood it from your background and literature, I know it's about migrants wanting the remittances to be used in a way which is consistent with their own preference.
Sure, exactly.
And they are not able to observe what the household receiving the remittances is doing. But how does the wife cohabiting with her own husbands against the preferences of the husband reduce information asymmetries.
You're totally right. So co-residents with the parents of the husband can reduce information asymmetries for the migrant, but co-residents with your own parents, if you want, can increase your bargaining power precisely because it increases information asymmetries. So it's not reduces, influences. It's true that with whom you co-reside, it makes a lot of difference. And that's why you have these seemingly divergent preferences between the two spouses. As I said, there's Mexican migrants, especially undocumented migrants, are clearly prevented from doing what internal migrants do. So there's evidence from Kenya that rural to urban migrants travel home a lot, and if they reside in a city that is far away so that commuting traveling time is too long, what they typically do is that they ask their siblings to visit the spouse left behind to monitor what is happening. There's also evidence from China, two papers by Chen, that wives left behind with their daughters tend to shift a greater share of household chores on their daughters with respect to what the migrant husband would prefer. So indeed, there can be different preferences. Yeah?
I'm quite interested in the results of co-residency on children's outcome.
Yeah.
So from what I understood, that co-residency with the grandparents leads to better education outcomes for the child.
When both, yes.
And literature also suggests that if the education level of the mother has quite a significant effect on her children's education outcomes. So did you find something with regards to that, particularly if you interact the mother's education with co-residency? So were there, my question is, were there any differences between mothers who were living with their parents based on the education of the mom, and if it affected the child's outcome?
Good suggestion. We have not yet checked this. We can do so only in the cases in which the mother is co-residing with the children, because if the mother has also left, we don't have, unfortunately, any information about her education. These results in particular that you were referring to, the fact that co-residence with grandparents when both parents have left is positively associated with school enrollment is at odds with other typical accounts in the sociological literature that tells that when there's one missing generation in a country where the literacy rate has been increasing over the past few decades, this is bad news for the children because it means that the caregivers are typically unable to follow them in their homeworks because they are illiterate. So why do we find the opposite? Again, this could be clearly due simply to the endogeneity of co-residing choices, but it could also be due to the fact that, as I told you, the typical alternative is the caregiver is the sister of the father or of the mother. It's an aunt. And typically, the aunt has children. So there could be a more intense competition for resources with the other children in the same age range than when you co-reside with grandparents, when no one else has to go to school. So
is the comparison based children living with their aunts as opposed to
with other caregivers that are not grandparents, typically is their aunts.
Oh.
Yeah.
I have two questions. So I think assuming you're very clear that saying that it's not causal what you have. But so I was thinking if you want to make it causal, why not go for the carbon mushi strategy? With Mexican migrants, use rainfall shocks.
Rainfall.
So, okay, exogenous variation in migration decision. Because the decision to migrate, the decision of good or good is our target to this decision. But I mean,
sure.
I will migrate more likely if I can show my children out with my wife, with my parents,
sure.
or her parents. So obviously you want to disentangle this co-intervention of these two decisions. And one way to do that is such as variation in the decision to migrate based on the rainfall gate that you have in the Taiwan Minshi paper, which is essentially pretty much mapping the same data that you have.
Yeah.
So that would be a very neat way of doing it, and I think that exploiting both across Mexico and also over time to have variation rainfall shocks would be a nice way to try to amplify the common effect.
So I take on board the suggestion, which is a good suggestion, with a caveat. So Munshi states that rainfall at origin in Mexico is a very good instrument for an endogenous variable at destination, but the problem is that changing weather conditions at origin not only influence migration, but could also influence local economic opportunities, and hence might also have a direct, if you want, influence on co-resident choices over and above the one that goes through the migration decision. But indeed, that's a good suggestion. The problem that we face, it's broader. There's very little on the determinants of co-resident choices. And so it's very difficult to defend the excludability of an instrument in general, beyond rainfall. Because basically we know very little about what are the correlates of changes in co-resident choices over time, which makes life hard when you have to defend an IV.
I have a second question, and that's a little different. There's a lot of debate about remittance and what are they used for, but you can just, I think this is very interesting, one can speak to that debate. Are they used for productive purposes, investment or consumption? So does it really matter for the male migrant whether his wife and children are with his parents or with the parents in law? Right. It could be argued that maybe the decision of remittance for investment is more when the wife stays with his parents versus when the wife stays with her parents. Right. So I think if we could disentangle that, it would be really valuable, because I think it's been very difficult to sort out this question of what are remittances used for. I think you might miss something about that.
I agree that this is a strand of literature that we clearly have in mind. Here we face, unfortunately, a binding data constraint. Because differently from the 2000 census, in 2010, the INEGI only asked question about whether you receive remittances, but no information on the amount. So it's, for us, it's a black and white question. We don't have information on the amount. But I do agree that this is a key issue. I totally agree.
I was just wondering, because we only focus on migration decisions where the husband moves first, basically, and if you could give an idea to what share of total migration this applies and to what extent this migration, like when maybe the female moves first to work as a domestic worker, for example, even domestically might be migrating from rural to urban areas.
Yeah. So in terms of total share of migration episodes. So the migration of, for men, I'm recalling from McKenzie and Rapoport 2011 on Restat, for men you have that around 40% of them migrate before getting married. And among those, and the rest are married, and two-thirds of them, so it's again 40% of the total, migrate alone, leaving the spouse back in Mexico, while around 20% move jointly with the spouse. Female migration, independent from the husbands, is still very rare. So you have some single mothers migrating, some single women, but if I try to do the converse, try to find fathers left behind that are likely to have their wife in the US, I basically find none of them. So it's truly an empirical regularity. There's this paper by Nobles on demography that tells that the international migration of the fathers is the first cause of separation between children and their fathers, over and above divorce, legal separation, so marriage dissolution, and even death. It's a truly big thing for Mexico. But clearly it's not the entire picture. It's not the entire picture.
It's possible also that there are different migration patterns that could be correlated with the co-residence. In the
sure.
sense that, for example, maybe if your plan is to bring your family to the US, maybe you want to save money faster, and maybe your wife moved to the cheapest possibility, not the apartment.
Definitely.
While if you plan to go along and to come back after a few years, maybe your strategy is different. So.
Definitely. I think that co-resident choices when the mother is still in Mexico is, I suspect, deeply correlated with the intention to migrate of the wife. Because if something that I hadn't told, of these 20,000 wives, there are only 500 that do not have children. All of them, almost all of them have children. So clearly, if they want to migrate, they have to find a living arrangement for their own children. So starting co-residing with their own parents is a stepping stone towards migration. Okay, so this is clear that everything is endogenous in this story. And we should take this into account. Something else that we are not fully able to capture, so we are also working on US data, where we observe Mexicans in the US from the American Community Survey. And what we observe there is that there's another important part of the story that we are not able to take into account, which is marriage dissolution. The incidence of divorce or remarriage among Mexicans in the US is way above the corresponding figures for Mexicans in Mexico. So here, as I told you, I'm able to identify a wife left behind only if she still reports to be married and report receives remittances. If the marriage is on the verge of dissolving, she might not tell you that she's married, she might not be receiving remittances, so we are already missing a part of the story. And the other thing that beyond the theoretical development, what we have not unfortunately been able to do for the 2020 Mexican census is that we should slightly change the way in which we phrase questions. This co-residence condition is meant to avoid double counting. That parents, for instance, and spouse living in different households both talk about the migration of the same person. Fine, but if you want to understand what happens to the left behind, this avoiding the risk of double counting generates a huge risk of not counting at all, which is problematic, given that this seems to be not random. Thanks a lot. Thanks all of you.